Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture.
The passion or emotional response of anger is among one of the most violent and troubling that human beings have to experience, and the Stoics took a very uncompromising attitude towards anger. Different than some of the other philosophical schools, which saw some usefulness to it, or perhaps even some sign of a good character in anger, the Stoics saw it as uniformly bad, and Epictetus is following the classic Stoic position lead in this. It's a strong emotion. The strong emotions as sort of confusions of the soul stemming from mistaken viewpoints on things and shaking us, you know, steering us into things, are uniformly bad. This doesn't mean that all emotions are necessarily bad, but certainly the emotional response of anger for Epictetus is going to be so. Although it will also be one that is understandable. So it's not, you know, purely irrational in the sense that it just comes out of nowhere and overcomes us and then steers us into things. There is actually a reasoning process involved in anger, as indeed there is in all of the emotions according to the Stoics. So what are the components that are going into anger? In general, now Epictetus doesn't spell this out quite so explicitly, but we'll look at what he does have to say about it in his own words in just a moment. There are several components that are going into anger as an emotion. And again, the Stoics are not the only people to identify these. This is fairly common in ancient philosophy across the schools. There's some sort of what the Stoics would call an appearance, a phantasia, combined with a judgment on that appearance, that thing that is showing itself to us, that the other person, the one that we're going to get angry at, did us some sort of harm. And perhaps we could even add here, there's usually an assumption going along with it that they meant to do that, that they were deliberate about it, or they were so careless that it's their fault that we got hurt. So it could be anything from spilling somebody's drink to, you know, saying an insensitive comment in their earshot, to going up to them and pushing them and saying, hey, get out of here, or saying a cutting word deliberately to hurt them. The scope of anger is far beyond just one's own person. We see people get angry at their favorite television characters being impugned in one way or another. We see people get into very heated discussions about fictional things that never existed and fictional universes and what is canonical and what is not. And we could go on and on and on. The main issue here is that there is some sort of perception of the other person as doing harm, whether out of contempt, out of, you know, deliberate sadism, or anything in between. And so there's a judgment going on. That's one of the things that you have in order to have anger. Along with that, there's an associated desire to retaliate against that person, or perhaps against, you know, an effigy of that person, or to retaliate in some other way, right? There's a desire to harm in return, to insult in return, to humiliate in return. There's also a desire, and Epictetus doesn't really spell this out, but we see this happening a lot. There's a desire quite often to want the other person to admit that they were wrong, right? And that's going to be totally fruitless, and we'll see why in a moment. So along with this desire to retaliate, or you might say sort of fused into that desire, is a judgment that retaliation is a good thing. That imposing a bad thing on somebody else is a good thing. That doing something that would ordinarily be wrong to do if one was the aggressor is right to do in these circumstances. All these sorts of judgments are built into the emotion of anger. So you see how complex anger is when we begin to analyze it. It's not something whose features we were, you know, always very acutely conscious of. We feel it rather than think it, but there is a thought process going on here. Usually our thinking when we're angry tends to be more, how can I get that SOB in these circumstances? How can I attain my vindication or my retribution? Now, there's a few things that Epictetus is going to point out in Book 1 that I want to particularly call your attention to. There are other things that are important in other books. You know, for instance, where he talks about habituation and anger. I'm going to reserve that for another core concept video. And I just want to focus on these three main things. One that's very important, and he talks about this in Chapter 15 of Book 1, we don't actually have control over other people's anger. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that we can't provoke them into being angry? No. If we know, you know, what somebody's buttons are, or we know in general how human beings are, we can get people angry. But it's not us that are, you might say, the final determinative cause of that. It's the way their own faculty of choice, their reasoning faculty, their highest faculty, the hegemonikon, the way it's arranged. And so if you go up to somebody that you know has anger issues and you start messing with them, you can pretty much be guaranteed that they're going to get angry. And they are angry because you're providing an occasion for it, and you might say, you know, a sort of impulse. But the main reason they're angry is because that's the way that they are geared to responding to things, because of the way they have come to be structured. You know, similarly, we can say people from certain societies or cultures, people of different temperaments, may be more prone to anger than others. But when we're worried, and the example here in chapter 15 is somebody comes to Epictetus and he says, "My brother's angry at me. I want him not to be angry with me. What can I do?" Epictetus says, "That's out of your control. Other people's proaireces is not something that lies within your control. You have control over your proaireces, your faculty of choice, what you do with yourself. You don't actually have control over what happens inside of his head or within his heart. He has to come to deal with that himself. Bring him to talk to me, and maybe I can talk some sense into him, but I'm not going to be able to give you anything that you can take to him." And actually, from an anger management perspective, this is really good advice, because when you've got people in relationships that already have a long history with each other, presumably these two brothers do, there's a tendency not to want to listen, even when the other person is talking sense, not to want to listen to them. And so a third party can come in and say, "Listen, your thought processes are all out of whack here. You really ought to rethink the way that you're acting towards your brother and the emotion that you're holding on to." So we don't actually have control over other people's anger. That lies outside of the scope of our own moral purpose or faculty of choice. That lies in the realm of things that we do not have power over, and so we should not preoccupy ourselves with that, or else we're going to make ourselves miserable. As a matter of fact, if we want to extend this advice, think about if you're in any sort of position of authority. You're always going to have people that aren't happy with the job that you're doing. Or if you're writing and you're putting your work out there, there's always going to be somebody complaining, quite often getting angry or taking offense at something that you say. It's almost impossible in the sort of society that we live in not to sooner or later offend somebody. If you're going to make that a measure of how you're doing, you're probably not going to be very happy, and you're going to be anxious and troubled. So, enough about that point. Now, the two main places where he really talks quite a bit about anger are chapter 18 and then chapter 28. In chapter 28, the discussion is a little bit more about general processes of reasoning, but he is going to hit on two really important points in this that can help us not to be angry, which is the goal for Stoics, right? Not to be angry so much at first, not to be angry so often at first, and then eventually, hopefully, not to be angry with anybody whatsoever, not even ourselves. So here's the two general points. If we can understand why people act as they do, then we can feel a different response. We can feel, whether you want to translate the Greek elein or elemosune as pity, which tends to have a sort of pejorative connotation in our time, or as compassion, which is seen as a good thing in our time. The Greek term is the same. That would translate both of those. It's a response to the other that says, "Okay, I can't really do anything about the fact that you feel that way. I wish it wasn't that way. You're badly off, and I feel for you," as we would often say. We can feel that response rather than anger when those people do indeed act badly from an objective point of view. He uses examples here of thieves, people stealing things, and he uses examples of adulterers. They are not behaving, you know, even though they think that it's the right way for them to behave, they are not behaving in a way that actually is right. They are mistaken about some pretty fundamental things. Perhaps in general, perhaps they've got some sort of problem that keeps them from seeing how their actions actually fall under that rule. We don't have to go too deep into speculation about that. I mean, all you got to do is walk around and watch people listen to their conversations, and you'll get plenty of material for this. So that's the first point. When we understand why people are behaving in the bad ways that they are, we're not actually negating the bad in that case, but we are saying, okay, I can feel for them rather than feeling like I need to retaliate against them. The other thing is, we get angry. This is for us. We get angry because we're misidentifying what really matters for us, what really is in our control, or what really is up to us, and we thereby think ourselves to be harmed or wronged. If somebody does something to me, say, you know, impugns my reputation, somebody puts a nasty comment on one of my videos, Dr. Sadler is a terrible teacher, and I don't know why they let him in any university, and he should be off of YouTube, and blah, 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 blah. Does that really affect me? From a Stoic perspective, that affects something external to me, which is how other people look at me. But there's nothing, you know, in the nature of things that says that I have to take that and incorporate it into my own point of view and say, oh, so-and-so doesn't like me. I've been harmed as a result. Instead, I said, well, you know, what I could do is what Epictetus actually said, the great advice. Well, if they actually knew more about me, they might have worse things to say about me, and then just sort of blow it off. That person doesn't really know what they're talking about. We can say the same thing for all sorts of other things. Somebody cuts you off in traffic. Are they really trying to hurt you as a result? Or let's say they are trying to hurt you. They're trying to beat you up, right? You know, they've got this mistaken perspective. If you are beaten up, that's just, from a Stoic perspective, that's just your body. That's not you. You still control how you, as a human being who has a faculty of choice, is going to react to it, what you're going to make of it. I know this sounds rather harsh, and if somebody was beating me up, I certainly would not be acting like a Stoic like that, but I, from a Stoic perspective, I'm not fully along the way. I'm not even really halfway along the way, to be quite honest. Now, let's look at a few passages that illustrate this. So, let's talk about the second one first. He says, here we go, this is from chapter 18. If you've been affected in some way that's contrary to nature at the misfortunes of another, pity him. Do not hate him. Drop this readiness to take offense in the spirit of hatred. Do not introduce those words which the multitude and the censurious use, these accursed and abominable fools. He says, well, that's great. How is it you've so suddenly been converted to wisdom that you're angry at fools? If you really have wisdom, then you're not going to be angry at the fools. Why then are we angry? Here is the key. Because we admire the goods of which those men rob us. For, mark you, stop admiring your clothes, and you are not angry at the man who steals them. Stop admiring your wife's beauty, and you're not angry at her adulterer. Know that a thief or an adulterer has no place among the things that are your own, but only among the things that are another's and that are not under your control. If you give these things up and count them as nothing, at whom have you still ground to feel angry? But as long as you admire these things, be angry at yourself and not at the men who I've just mentioned. For consider, you have fine clothes and your neighbor does not. You have a window and wish to air them. He does not know wherein the true good of man consists, but fancies it consists in having fine clothes. The very same fancy you also entertain. Shall he not come then and carry them off? Why, when you show a cake to gluttonous men and then gulp it all down to yourself, are you not wanting them to snatch it? Stop provoking them. Stop having a window. Stop airing your clothes. And this, again, sounds rather difficult. It sounds like, well, you just withdraw from everything. That is indeed Epictetus's advice. Don't get too attached to the things that you don't really have control over. From a student's perspective, for example, your grades, your evaluations, whether you get the class that you want, whether you graduate on time, whether you're, you know, somebody offers you a job at the job fair, from the perspective of a parent, whether your kid behaves the way that they ought to. I mean, all you have to do is have kids for a little while, just babysit, and you'll realize that there are other people who have very different views on what ought to be done in any given situation. And you know, we can go on and on and on with this. Back to the understanding why people do the things they do. Chapter 28 is particularly good about that. He says, "What is the reason we assent to anything? The fact that it appears to us to be so. It is impossible to assent to the thing that appears not to be so. Why? This is the nature of the intellect, to agree with what is true, to be dissatisfied with what is false, and so on." And so he says, so when we get people who are behaving in a certain way that we think is off base, that would make us angry, probably would make them angry as well, we can indeed understand their perspective without agreeing with it. We can say, aha, that seems reasonable to them. That's why they're behaving that way. It's unfortunate because they're off base, and so we should pity them rather than getting angry with them, because the anger isn't actually going to fix anything. They're still going to have the same screwed up beliefs that they have, the same screwed up habits, the same screwed up desires, and us getting angry may, you know, keep them from doing stuff to us, to the external things, for a little while, but it's really not going to change anything fundamentally. So he uses the example of Medea. He says, Medea was, you know, for those who don't know, you should read Euripides' Medea. Medea is a woman who is terribly mistreated by her husband, Jason, who's a real schmuck, actually. He's one of the schmuckiest of the Greek heroes. He's always got other people doing the heavy lifting for him. He only manages to get the Golden Fleece by effectively seducing Medea. More, she chooses him than anything else, and she incurs some horrible costs to ensure his safety. Then has children with him. Then he decides to throw her over and marry another local princess. So she says, now I learn what horrors I intend, but passion overmastereth sober thought. Epictetus says, it is because the very gratification of her passion and the taking of vengeance on her husband she regards as more profitable than the saving of her children. Medea kills her children. Yes, but she is deceived. This is the objection. Show her clearly, then, that she is deceived, and she will not do it. But as long as you do not show it, what else has she to follow than that which appears to her to be true? Nothing. Why, then, are you angry with her? Because the poor woman has gone astray in the greatest matters and has been transformed from a human being into a viper. Why do you not, if anything, rather pity her? As we pity the blind and the halt, why do we not pity those who have been made blind and halt in their governing faculties? When we say that somebody lacks something that they would ordinarily be able to use, we shouldn't be angry at them for that. We should actually feel sorry for them, is what Epictetus says. And Medea furnishes a prime case for this in ancient literature. And we could think of many, many other cases as well if we just put our minds to it. We don't even need to do that necessarily. If you're like me, I can just consult my memories, and I don't even have to go back in time. I can consult my recent memories and have enough material to work with to try to put this sort of thing into practice.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.